funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Fired FBI Director James Comey is moving into closed-door questioning now with the Senate Intelligence Committee. He spent the morning in an open session, sharing a detailed accounting of his interactions with President-elect and then-President Trump. Comey says it wasn't his practice to take notes immediately following his meetings with former President Obama, but that he felt compelled to document his conversations with President Trump, including Mr. Trump's alleged statement that he expected loyalty and his expression that he hoped Comey would let go of any FBI investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. So what does all of this say about the relationship between the country's intelligence services and the White House? And what does it mean for a presidential administration not quite 5 months into its tenure? We have two expert guests with us this hour to talk about everything that's been happening. Rebecca Dean is chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. Dale Carpenter is chair of constitutional law at SMU's Dedman School of Law. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How credible did James Comey sound here? Did he come across as a sincere public servant, as the president has said, a nut job, some combination of both?
I thought he was incredibly self-possessed and clear. Dale and I were visiting before the show started about what a good job he did of writing his introductory statement, how straightforward it was. I think he came across as open, as wanting to divulge as much as he could without navigating into waters that were inappropriate. All in all, I thought he did a good job.
I agree with all of that. I think he was careful. He was concise. I think it was a mark of the seriousness of his testimony that when a senator that might be critical of President Trump tried to lead him further than he wanted to go, he actually resisted going any further than he thought was appropriate, and that seemed to me to be calibrated exactly correctly for the momentousness of an occasion like this.
There were things, Dale, that he couldn't say because of other aspects of this investigation, other levels of the investigation that may involve classified material. What's most significant, though, about what he refused to answer?
Well, I mean, we don't know really what the allegations are and what the evidence is so far that's been developed in the concern about Russia's involvement in the last election. We have a vague idea from some leaks in the media, but there are a lot of specifics we just don't know. And they may involve members of President Trump's campaign. They may involve the fired Mike Flynn. They may involve President Trump himself. We just don't know.
Rebecca, assuming for the sake of the discussion that it's true that there are no allegations against President Trump himself, but if there are concerns about members of his staff and about people who are serving with him closely in the White House, what would be the implications for this administration that is really just getting going? It's only been not even 5 months.
Right. So I'm sure your listeners have heard about the presidential honeymoon that we typically think of in the first couple of months in an administration. And what's been so striking with this administration is that there was almost none, and largely of the president's own creation, when he would make mistakes and have gaffes. And I think that the closer this gets directly to the president himself, the more difficult it becomes for the president to just carry out the normal activities of what we expect the president to do, let alone try to pursue some of the more controversial aspects of his agenda, for example, vis-a-vis immigration.
All right. Some of this is, as many people have noted, he said, right? There may or may not be tapes, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. I want to play just a minute or two here from former Director Comey's opening statement.
He told me repeatedly that he had talked to lots of people about me, including our current attorney general, and had learned that I was doing a great job and that I was extremely well-liked by the FBI workforce. So it confused me when I saw on television the president saying that he actually fired me because of the Russia investigation, and learned again from the media that he was telling privately other parties that my firing had relieved great pressure on the Russia investigation. I was also confused by the initial explanation that was offered publicly, that I was fired because of the decisions I had made during the election year. That didn't make sense to me for a whole bunch of reasons, including the time and all the water that had gone under the bridge since those hard decisions that had to be made. That didn't make any sense to me. And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. And I am so sorry that the FBI workforce had to hear them, and I'm so sorry that the American people were told them.
That was former FBI Director James Comey testifying today before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Comey noted later in questioning that he had no doubt that Russia tried to interfere with the 2016 elections, but that he was confident no votes cast were interfered with by the Russians or were altered. He seemed to corroborate President Trump's claims that he told him on three separate occasions that he, Mr. Trump, was not personally under investigation. That doesn't mean that he meant that President Trump would never be under investigation.
That's right. In fact, one of the reasons he didn't want to announce publicly that President Trump wasn't currently under investigation is that that would create a duty to correct the record with the public later on if, in fact, the president came under investigation, because during an investigation, you can learn all kinds of things that you didn't expect when you interview witnesses, when you see documents, when you develop intelligence. And so I think he was avoiding having to replay, in a sense, what happened in the summer of 2016 in the presidential campaign when the Clinton email scandal came to light and the director had announced that there was an investigation going on, and then there wasn't, then there was, and he didn't want to go back to that with a sitting president.
A lot of us in the general public are still learning about how these things work. Rebecca, it was significant, at least Mr. Comey seems to believe so, that he had 9 meetings with President Trump, 3, I believe, in person and 6 over the phone. He had had very few meetings with Presidents Bush or Obama, and he didn't feel the need to document carefully the content of those meetings after they happened. What does it say that Mr. Comey went back, took notes, and shared those notes with at least some of his top leadership?
Well, I think it says a couple of things. I would actually tie it to the tape that you just played, where Mr. Comey said explicitly that those were lies. That's a very strong word, especially someone with his background and with his previous experience wouldn't use that word without intention. And so I think the two are linked, right? So he's trying, as you know, with prosecutorial experience, he's trying to create a contemporaneous record, as was talked about many times this morning, so that he wouldn't have to rely on his memory, so that he would have data on which to draw right from that very account. And then in terms of how this relates to a normal, I say that with air quotes, presidency, the first thing that strikes me is, again, something that Dale and I were talking about earlier, that the FBI, though it sits under DOJ, is an independent by its nature and by the way the nature of what the Bureau does, but also what we think of in terms of independent investigations. And so for the president to have direct conversations with that director so many times within a short period of time strikes me, as someone who spent a lot of time in presidential archives, as interesting.
Yes, it's one of the things that law students learn early in their law school careers is that it's a cardinal principle of American constitutional order that we are a government of laws and not of men. That is to say, we live under the rule of law. We don't live under the rule of individual caprice and arbitrary action. That is to say, everybody, including the president, is subject to the law and has to obey the law and can't alter the law simply out of their own self-interest. And that's the danger that's created by a president who reduces the space between the FBI and the White House, is that we abandon that cardinal principle.
The president has hinted that there might be tapes of the interactions between him and Mr. Comey. Mr. Comey said multiple times today he hopes there are tapes. If those tapes exist, would the president be compelled to turn them over?
Well, we have litigated this issue once before in American history. We
Indeed.
Did it 44 years ago now, I guess 43 years ago, when President Nixon had made tapes of White House conversations. And Those tapes became a subject of investigation by a special prosecutor and by the House in an impeachment proceeding. And ultimately, the president claimed that he didn't have to release the tapes because he had an executive privilege not to release the evidence of discussions that he had with close associates in the White House. The special prosecutor went to court and said, no, you have to release them because we've got an ongoing criminal investigation and we need them. And again, this is a case that we teach first semester, second semester of law school. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Nixon had to release those tapes. And once they were released, they revealed evidence that President Nixon had, in fact, been the hub of a criminal conspiracy to cover up the Watergate affair by ordering that the investigation of the Watergate affair cease.
Some people have argued that the president is trying to threaten Director Comey by suggesting that those tapes existed, like maybe something exists on them that that would somehow implicate Director Comey. Did you hear, Rebecca, evidence that Director Comey was trying to frame anything that might put him in a negative light that might appear on tapes that, this is such a theoretical question, that may or may not exist?
I want to make sure I understand the question. So are you asking whether or not Comey, in his testimony, was trying to preempt something that might be on...
Much more beautifully stated than I put it, yes.
Might be on a tape. I'm gonna channel my inner Comey here. It's difficult to get into the mind of what Comey might have been thinking at the time. I'm sure that as he's talking, again, giving his experience, that he's going to want to hedge his bets against what might be out there that could be proof in the opposite direction of what he's saying. In other words, to disprove, he wants to make sure that if there's, I assume he wants to be honest, but aside from that, if there's proof to the contrary, he wants to make sure that what he says is in line with that. But what struck me the most was the way that he was very careful in his testimony about what might not be 100% true. So he would say, I think that this is true. I might have this date wrong. Or this was my impression, I could have been wrong. So I think that it both in his testimony that he prepared, his opening statement that he prepared and released to the public last night, where the things that were in quotes were the things that referenced his contemporaneous note-taking. And then today, when he was very careful to say, this I'm sure, this I'm not sure.
I think I agree with that. I think Comey was extraordinarily self-confident about the core of his testimony. That is, the matters that related to, for example, the president asking or demanding loyalty from him, clearing the room so that he could have discussions one-on-one with Comey in the White House at a dinner and then...
This is highly unusual.
Highly unusual for this to happen. Inappropriate, really, especially given the nature of the discussion that they had. Asking Comey to consider dropping the investigation of Michael Flynn, which we can talk about what that means in the context in which it was said to Director Comey, and then lift the cloud on the administration. I don't think Comey has any doubt about what was said, and I think the attitude I heard was, Mr. President, if you have tapes, bring them on, because they're going to support what I have to say.
We're speaking this hour with Dale Carpenter, who is chair of constitutional law at SMU's Dedman School of Law, and with Rebecca Dean, chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington, about former FBI Director James Comey's testimony today before the Senate Intelligence Committee. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for aspiring creative writers. You can nurture your creative talents and take courses this fall like 21st Century Storytelling. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Rebecca Dean, who chairs the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington, and Dale Carpenter, who is chair of constitutional law at the Dedman School of Law at SMU. We're talking about former FBI Director James Comey's testimony today before the Senate Intelligence Committee. I want to play some sound here of Senator James Risch, Republican of Idaho, asking Director Comey about obstruction of justice.
Do you know of any case where a person has been charged for obstruction of justice, or for that matter, any other criminal offense where they said or thought they hoped for an outcome?
I don't know well enough to answer. And the reason I keep saying his words is I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the President of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
You may have taken it as a direction, but that's not what he said.
Correct.
He said, I hope.
Those are exact words.
Okay.
Correct.
You don't know of anyone that's ever been charged for hoping something. Is that a fair statement?
I don't, as I sit here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dale Carpenter, do you know of anyone who's been charged with obstruction of justice for hoping?
I don't personally know of a charge when someone said, I hope that you'll drop an investigation. But I also don't know of an occasion when a president has sat the FBI director down in the White House after saying, do you want your job? Do you like your job? There are a lot of other people who would like your job. I need loyalty from you. I don't know of another case where a president has said that to an FBI director about an ongoing investigation. It's one thing when an individual, say a person charged with a white-collar crime, may say something like that. It's another thing entirely when the President of the United States says it to the director of the FBI, which is supposed to be an independent investigative body. And we do actually have a statute that deals with what it means to obstruct justice. And those elements, are potentially present in a case like this, and it's certainly a matter that the special prosecutor will be looking at very closely. It's the one thing that came out of the hearing that I think is potentially the most damaging to President Trump, and that's the discussion about the Flynn investigation.
Rebecca, let's just say that this falls short of the legal definition of obstruction of justice, but that the conversation played out in the way that former Director Comey said it did. What does this do to the president politically?
Right. So when I was listening to that testimony where the senator was focused on these words, I hope, and what does I hope mean? You know, in Washington, there's an understood subtext behind many things. And there's a difference, for example, between when the president's members of his administration or a secretary of a particular agency or somebody on the White House staff says something. There's sort of a level of escalation. Also, the closer physically that a person is to the president in terms of where they office, it's assumed that person is closer to the president and is more readily able to speak for him. So when the president himself says something, it's the ultimate in escalation. So I think it's super significant that it's the president saying this directly to then FBI director in a private meeting. And again, I go back to my experience looking through presidential archives, and the number of times it's a one-on-one between the president and someone else is very rare. There's almost always someone else in the room. And in part, it's for the president's protection to corroborate what's going on. So all of these things, I think, are striking and can begin to chip away potentially at his base, though we've seen that his base has been so very strong for him. And really, that's so as a political question, a separate from the legal question, that's really what we're talking about, is the extent to which this gets him in trouble with his base, because that's what's held so far through previous problems the administration has had.
His base really seems to like the fact that he is an outsider. He doesn't do things the way every politician they've known in the past has done it. If indeed the conversation went down, as Mr. Comey suggests, could it reasonably be argued that it or interpreted as kind of a manifestation of Mr. Trump's personal communication style, the fact that that's how he leads rather than some sort of effort at coercive tactics?
Could be. I mean, I think if I were the president's lawyer, I would put the best possible face on it, which is this is just the sort of braggadocio that the president uses when he talks to people. And I think I might say that he was just trying to relieve the pressure on a fundamentally good man, and the director agreed that Flynn was a good man and so forth. But I think it's problematic when a president uses that kind of language alone in the presence of the FBI director who's in charge of conducting these investigations and who ultimately can be fired by the president and who ultimately was fired by the president. I think another important point to make here is Comey pointed out that this did not end the investigation into Michael Flynn, and it didn't end the investigation into Russian influence in the American election. So it didn't have the effect of obstructing justice. But to commit that crime, one doesn't have to have succeeded in obstructing justice. It's enough to attempt to obstruct justice to have violated the statute.
Absent obstruction of justice, is there anything illegal about a president firing someone for spite?
No, the president can fire the director of the FBI. He doesn't have to have a good reason or a bad reason or no reason at all. If he has an illegal reason, that raises potential problems for the president, I think, legally and also politically when we get into the impeachment process, which is a fundamentally political process. But it's certainly the president has the power to fire the director of the FBI. He can fire the attorney general. It's happened before.
Yeah, though typically, that is absolutely true. Though typically there is some conversation about cause, right? So it's wrapped up in a substantive reason rather than I just don't get along with you or I just don't think you're doing a good job in the abstract.
The president gave what might be called a couple of substantive reasons or not substantive reasons, depending on how you interpret things.
Right. And again, I think that gets back to the problems that the president creates for himself not sticking to a message.
There was talk when it was first announced that former Director Comey would testify that the Trump administration might try to invoke an executive privilege to keep Comey from testifying, certainly publicly. I don't know if that would have affected private testimony or not. Did that become impossible because of his conversations, the president's statements in public?
I think if the president had, so there are two separate questions here. One is the constitutional question of whether the president has an executive privilege to prevent the director of the FBI from discussing these things with Congress. The other question is the political one of whether the president could do it. I think the president has a legal argument that he has executive privilege. I think ultimately that privilege could be overcome, just as it was in the case of Nixon in Watergate. The larger problem for the president, I think, would have been if he had claimed executive privilege, it would have looked more and more to the public like a full-blown cover-up.
Let's listen to Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. He's a Democrat. He asked about Comey's experience being asked to promise loyalty to the president.
Despite you explaining your independence, he kept coming back to, I need loyalty, I expect loyalty. Had you ever had any of those kind of requests before from anyone else you'd work for in the government?
No. And what made me uneasy was, I'm, at that point, the director of the FBI. The reason that Congress created a 10-year term is so that the director is not feeling as if they're serving with political loyalty owed to any particular person. The statue of justice has a blindfold on because you're not supposed to be peeking out to see whether your patron is pleased or not with what you're doing. It should be about the facts and the law. That's why I became FBI director, to be in that kind of position. So that's why I was so uneasy.
Rebecca, what does this alleged demand for loyalty from Comey to the president, what does that do to the president's supporters within the legislature? Is it the sort of thing that they believe their guy deserves?
So I think to demand loyalty from the FBI director is different than a conversation about which person is the best person to put in as Secretary of Agriculture. I really think there's a distinction here between the different types of people who have presidential appointments and Senate confirmations. You know, I think back as you're replaying the tape, I was thinking about LBJ and I was thinking about FDR and the way that they prefer to have people that knew that, I mean, every president wants somebody they know they can count on, but those two come to mind specifically as, you know, we have evidence from looking at the archival material of the ways that their they and their advisors would have conversations about, we want to pick this person rather than that person because this person's our guy and that person's not our guy, or we can't be sure that this person is going to toe the line for us. But these are in positions that are important, but they don't have separate investigatory ability and responsibility. So I would just draw that distinction.
I also think this may be, Rebecca and I talked about this earlier before the show, I think the loyalty demand or request, however you want to put it, may be another instance of a culture clash, where President Trump comes from this world in which he's the CEO, he runs things, the casinos run under him, people do what he says, and that's what he expects of them. But Comey is the very careful, thoughtful, moderate director of an independent investigative agency. And to him, a request for loyalty sounds very, very different than Trump may have been intending it to mean.
What conditions would have to be met in order to compel the president to, first of all, definitively say if there are tapes of these conversations and then turn them over?
What kind of circumstances?
Yeah.
I think that the committee, in this case the Senate Intelligence Committee, could simply request that the White House reveal whether there are any tapes. And by the way, it's not just tapes. There is the possibility that there are memos at the White House that recorded that these meetings happened and what was said in these meetings. The committee could request any documents related to these discussions with Director Comey. And then it would be up to the president to say at that point whether he's going to invoke executive privilege not to release those tapes and the documents. And then we get into, I think, the potential for a clash in court. The same kind of request could be made and I think will be made from the special prosecutor, even if the Senate Intelligence Committee does not request them. So we're going to get these tapes, I think, ultimately, if they exist.
Also, typically, White Houses are very meticulous in documenting who comes to see the president at what particular time, when phone calls are made at what particular time, where the president is and with whom he's with. Sometimes that's referred to as the TikTok. And so presumably that's subpoenable as well.
And in what Comey describes, there are multiple witnesses to the president telling people to leave the room so that he can be alone with Comey. We have the amazing circumstances in which the attorney general is lingering around in the Oval Office, according to Comey, and President Trump finally tells him, I need you to leave because I need to speak to Comey. And then Jared Kushner is lingering around, and President Trump tells him to get out. So we have a lot of witnesses to the fact that these meetings occurred. We know that that at least can be verified.
A lot of congressional Republicans, Rebecca, have said openly that they were reluctant to throw their support in with President Trump, but he is the Republican president, and so they are on board. What does all of this controversy do to their lasting support for him? Are people likely to stick with the president if he is the leader of their party simply because they still hope that their legislative agenda will prevail if he sits in the Oval Office?
The late, great Tip O'Neill said all politics is local, and it really comes down to electoral politics. And so I think this is pure supposition, but my gut tells me that one of the reasons why you've seen the Senate committees proceed well and the House committee not proceed well is that the timeline for reelection in the two bodies are different, 2 years versus 6 years. And so I think that in places, so those are states on the part of senators or districts on the part of members of Congress, in the places where Republican members feel more electoral pressure, either because they're afraid they're going to get primaried, that is to say, have somebody run who is more Trumpian, more conservative, I say that in air quotes, then they are in, they feel more in electoral jeopardy, versus someone who has a district that's perhaps more moderate or comes from a state that's perhaps more of a swing state and feels more confident to move away from the president more quickly.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You've both raised the word impeachment, and so I want to know, there's a lot here that people are uncomfortable with. What does it take for people's concerns with what's happened to rise to the level of impeachment legally and politically? Because those are two different questions, really.
Yeah. I'll take the political angle. So the last impeachment that we were witness to was, of course, President Clinton's, and the political environment is polar opposite. So President Clinton faced an opposition Congress, and President Trump faces a party, a Congress of his own party. And so the comments that I made just a minute ago become really important in terms of when members of Congress feel that either electoral pressure or personal code of ethics pressure to move in the direction of an impeachment proceedings.
I know that some legal scholars have looked into the question of what are the factors that have to come together for a president actually to be impeached. And part of it's a legal or constitutional question, but part of it relies on these political considerations. And they've coalesced around four different factors that you could take into account. What is the president's standing with the public? Is the president popular? Is he trusted? Does he have the basic support of the public? Second, what is the president's overall relationship with the Congress? Does the Congress support the president? Does the Congress think that he's dealing honestly with them? Third, what is the president's standing with the members of his own party, which in this case, as Rebecca pointed out, control the Congress? Even if they didn't, it would be difficult to remove him because a party usually is able to block an impeachment and a removal in the Senate. And then fourth and finally, how serious are the substantive core charges that have been made? In this case, that there's been obstruction of justice potentially with the investigation of Michael Flynn early in the Trump administration. So I'm not sure that those four things have coalesced yet to make for an impeachment, but we are just at the beginning of an excavation, really, of what's happened here.
That's right, because we haven't yet seen even the beginnings of Bob Mueller's work.
And Michael Flynn has not commented publicly, having asked for immunity, right, to testify initially. All right, we're speaking this hour with Rebecca Dean of the University of Texas at Arlington and Dale Carpenter of SMU's Dedman School of Law. We're talking about former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your appreciation of great works of art by customizing your study with courses this fall like Inspiring Creativity Through Original Art. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
Now, here's the question. You're big, you're strong. I know the Oval Office, and I know what happens to people when they walk in. There is a certain amount of intimidation. But why didn't you stop and say, Mr. President, this is wrong. I cannot discuss this with you.
It's a great question. Maybe if I were stronger, I would have. I was so stunned by the conversation that I just took it in. And the only thing I could think to say, because I was playing in my mind, because I was going to remember every word he said, I was playing in my mind, what should my response be? And that's why I very carefully chose the words. And look, I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes. I remember saying, I agree he's a good guy, as a way of saying I'm not agreeing with what you just asked me to do. Again, maybe other people would be stronger in that circumstance, but that's how I conducted myself. I hope I'll never have another opportunity. Maybe if I did it again, I would do it better.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about James Comey's testimony today before the Senate Intelligence Committee with Dale Carpenter, Chair of Constitutional Law at SMU's Dedman School of Law, and Rebecca Dean, Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. You just heard Dianne Feinstein of California questioning former Director Comey. It certainly was a fair question. Why did he not confront the president? It also leads me to the question of what Jeff Sessions knew about all this. The answer that former Director Comey has given is that everybody understood that Sessions intended to recuse himself from the investigation into links between the Russians and members of the Trump staff and campaign. Does that hold water? Is that reasonable to not tell someone like the Attorney General about concerns?
I think it was the one part of Comey's testimony that I just didn't quite get. I don't understand why he didn't tell Attorney General Sessions. And I didn't. There may be an explanation for that, but I didn't hear it in the hearing today, and we don't get it in his prepared testimony. And I don't know how he knew, which is another issue he may not be able to talk about, I don't know how he knew that Sessions was going to recuse himself from the Russia investigation at that point. That's another mystery here that I'm just not sure of. I think these are ancillary questions, but they are genuine questions.
As I was listening to the testimony, I was struck by the number of points at which it just got interesting. And then they would say, well, we can't go into this in open session. It reminds me of going through presidential archives and you get to the dreaded pink. Sometimes it's pink, sometimes it's blue, but it stands for something that's been pulled for national security reasons. And it's so frustrating because you just get to the good part. And I sort of think that this is in that vein. I think there is something interesting underlying that, but we don't know. We don't know if we don't know it because of national security reasons, or if we don't know it because they just didn't get into that aspect of it. But I was struck by the unease with which it sounds as if Director Comey was operating with Attorney General Sessions. It didn't sound like the kind of relationship that I'm used to reading about between the folks who were in those two positions.
Is there anything that Director Comey can't say in the closed-door session with the Senate Intelligence Committee, in which everybody has clearance for classified material?
Unless the I can't think of anything because I'm not sure, but unless the president has somehow covertly asserted some executive privilege over some matter that he may be asked about in the executive session, then I think there would be a question about whether he could testify as to those matters, but I'm just speculating here. I really don't know. Otherwise, I think Comey's free to talk about anything that he needs to talk about.
Rebecca, in the prepared remarks that Comey put together before his testimony today that were released yesterday, he skirted around the details of these embarrassing, uncorroborated, possible compromising revelations about the president in Russia before he even ran for president. I'm wondering if you think that he included those, just the reminder of those, as any kind of way of positioning the president in a foolish light or in a light that suggests that maybe he is someone who could be corrupted.
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know, of course. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation is to get on the record how unusual an election this was and how an unusual a situation where you have someone whose life had been to that point so open. So in other words, because Mr. Trump, prior to running for office, was a very public celebrity figure, was in the tabloids a lot, did not have the past experience and past exposure to the media that a typical politician might. So that was unusual, right, about the context of the election. And then to have these allegations that came from supposedly a Russian ex-spy, that were these salacious details that may or may not have been true, that might be an opportunity to blackmail. I mean, the tangled web here is something of a novel, right? So it could be that the former director just wanted to get that out there, that this was such an unusual sort of environment in which we were operating, with so many different layers of truth and maybe truth. And I also took him at his word when he said, I wanted to make sure that the president didn't think that this was some sort of Hoover operation, right, where the FBI was going to be used as a political instrument to try to score political points against the president.
I think he was also, I think all of that is sounds right to me. And I think, but for purposes of this testimony, I think he included that at the beginning, not gratuitously, but because he was trying to record all for the Senate, all of the substantive meetings he had had with the president so that he didn't leave out any of these substantive meetings. There were some other phone calls, I think, that were mentioned in the hearings, three or four, that were much less substantive that did not make it into this memorandum. But it seems to me that's that recording this is part of that idea of getting the information that's most important out to the Senate.
Okay, this is both a legal and a political question, so I'll ask both of you to answer. It is hardly unheard of for presidents to appoint someone to a very important position who turns out to have skeletons in the closet or have behaved inappropriately on the job. Those people have to be fired or forced to tender their resignations. But when that happens, presidents typically say nothing more than, I wish this individual the best, and now they're gone. Why would President Trump go out of his way on multiple occasions to defend Michael Flynn, given the seriousness of the allegations against him?
Well, I think on the one hand, it sort of speaks to the president's way of operating in the world, which is different than what we normally expect of presidents, right? So I teach classes on the presidency, and I now have to preface the way it's usually done, as opposed to how it's being done in this administration. So I think that's one thing always to keep in mind with President Trump. And then I think the other thing is that we have seen, and others have tried to do sort of, you know, psychoanalysis of the president, but we have seen him clearly taking things very personally and acting very defensively. And so I think that he had this sense of Flynn was part of my team and he was being treated inappropriately roughly, and that reflects on me, and so I am going to defend him.
Yes, I think that's entirely likely. Probably the least charitable way, and I'll take it from the legal perspective here, the least charitable spin one could put on what the president did in defending Flynn after he was fired was that it's conceivable that Flynn knows something about President Trump or about the campaign or about the contacts with the Russians that is not favorable legally to the Trump administration. And so having fired Flynn, Trump wanted to make it clear that he had done it really against his will. He was forced into doing it. He thought that Flynn was a good man. You want to keep your friends close, but you want to keep your enemies closer. And this may have been an instance of that.
But legally, if Flynn knows something about the president or his associates and is called upon to testify to this, he's required, no matter how far the president stuck his neck out to protect him, to divulge that. Is that correct?
He could assert his Fifth Amendment privilege, which I believe he's doing, not to testify about any of these matters because they could implicate him in a crime. And he wants now, apparently, he wants some kind of immunity in order to testify, which suggests there may be something out there that is indeed unfavorable.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What could that demand for immunity? Are you willing to speculate on what could cause him to ask for immunity?
Well, I mean, it may be that his contacts with the Russian ambassador were illegal. I don't know. It may be that they were more extensive than we know. It may be that the substance of those contacts was troubling, because once you start to testify about what you said to the Russian ambassador and what he said to you, you get into all kinds of matters that could implicate him or others in ways that are at a minimum unethical and at worst illegal.
All right, let's go to the phones here. Ken is on the line in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. For those of us who actually know the facts of Watergate, the tendency is to look for parallels in this scandal and compare it to the Watergate affair. I wonder if you both could just assess the value of searching for parallels in history like this.
What do you think?
Well, I think that looking to history is always helpful. I'll say that as a blanket statement. I think that both in terms of how things have played out in the past politically, how those things then get institutionalized. I think that that's super important. I also think an honest and frank comparison of facts is important. We don't know, to give President Trump the benefit of the doubt, we don't know if there was collusion with the Russians. We don't know whether or not there was obstruction. There's a whole host of things that we don't know.
Let me interrupt you to be clear. We know at least the security agencies of this country have reached the conclusion that the Russians were involved in trying to influence the elections. What we don't know is whether anybody in the Trump camp knew that that was going on or participated in any way.
Exactly so. And so I'm referring here directly to the president. What the president knew, to borrow from Watergate, what the president knew and when he knew it. So there's a whole host of things that we don't know about President Trump. Let's assume that the worst that we could imagine is true. Okay, he's still not as good at it as Nixon was. The way in which President Nixon used the FBI, tried to leverage the CIA against the FBI, tried to use the power of his office to cover up the crime of the break-in was more savvy than anything that we've seen so far.
Yeah, I mean, there are comparisons to Watergate. I don't want to make them too strong. I mean, after all, the Nixon administration and the Justice Department were paying out hush money to witnesses. We don't have any evidence that anything like that has happened, at least yet. That's why you conduct an investigation. You find out what happens.
I really thought that we would be talking about the president's stated plan to live tweet today's hearings. Rebecca, why do you think we haven't seen that? I've refreshed my Twitter feed on the president's page multiple times and seen nothing.
I'm really surprised, actually. You know, folks are going to do the folks who do research on politics, the media are having a field day with when the president tweets and when the tweets are his versus, you know, his personal device versus other people's. I think maybe for once he listened to his advisors. And they took it away from him, and he didn't, you know, demand it back. I'm actually very surprised.
The president has legal jeopardy here. I'm not saying that he's going to be convicted or even indicted or that he's far from saying he's going to be impeached. But there is legal jeopardy here. And if there's one time your attorney, and he now has a personal attorney in this matter, would come down on you, it's at this moment, it seems to me. Nothing impetuous.
So if you were the president's attorney or the attorney for a client like him, you would take the phone away?
As his attorney, I would take it away. I think the problem for the president is the legal answer to what he should do now is very clear. He shouldn't say anything. The problem is, I think, his political problem of he needs to say something. There have just now been explosive claims made in a public hearing in the Senate. And that is a political matter. It's not just a legal matter. Those two things are intertwined.
All right. Looks like we are at the beginning of what is likely to be a very long story. Dale Carpenter is chair of constitutional law at the Dedman School of Law at SMU. Rebecca Dean is chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas at Arlington. It's been wonderful to speak with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about what we have planned for upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.